Let's call Masecho the Sefer and the Tovim. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. The chairman said too much, but he left out the crucial item of information. He didn't announce the topic. I suspect that's because I am anticipated to speak about Kol HaTorah Kula Al Regel Achas, which is quite impossible, I assure you. I was asked to speak this evening about reproductive technology, assisted procreation, the fertility problems, etc., etc. And I suggested that that might be overreaching a bit, and that one really ought to begin by talking about the status of the fetus in halacha, which is where all the serious problems with regard to reproductive technology lie. And then, perhaps, depending upon time, talk about various forms of assisted reproduction. Everybody knows the problems with regard to abortion. Those problems center primarily upon the status of the fetus. And so, I think we ought to begin from the beginning. But, truth in advertising, let me begin with a disclaimer. I will make no attempt to be absolutely comprehensive, to mention every particular opinion and shita that exists that would be A, confusing, and B, impossible. I will try to talk about the major streams of thought with regard to these problems, to identify the major shitas and poskim, and then to go wherever it will take us. So let me begin from the beginning. The beginning with regard to the status of a fetus is the Mishnah in Olos. The Mishnah tells us, Isho shin makasha lele, you have a woman who is in hard travail, is the literal translation. It is a woman who's having difficulty in pregnancy, labor is protracted, and generally in antiquity that was because the circumference of the head of the fetus was too large for the birth canal, presumably the result of hydrocephalitis, but be that as it may, the diagnosis isn't important, it's the treatment. What do you do? Today, I suppose, we would do a cesarean, not I suppose, but you would identify this much, much earlier in pregnancy. The woman would never be allowed to go into labor in the first place, and you would do a C-section. However, in antiquity, although cesareans were known, but A, the diagnosis was not always known in advance, and B, the cesarean procedure was extremely dangerous and almost always fatal during the tkufa of the Mishnah. There were certain exceptions. Caesar, the Roman Caesar, being the most notable such figure in history, who at least in terms of the history that's come down to us, was delivered by cesarean. In any event, the Mishnah tells us that when it's perfectly obvious that this child is not going to be born normally, mechatchin es havlad b'me'eho omitzino yisoy evorim evorim. The Mishnah says that you perform a surgical procedure which is well known today. It's called an embryotomy. Literally, you take the fetus apart limb by limb. And, says the Mishnah, what is the justification for this? Mipnei shechayeho kaidmi l'chayov. The life of the mother takes precedence over the life of the fetus, and if necessary in such extreme circumstances, the fetus is sacrificed in order to preserve the life of the mother. If you allow labor to continue, the woman is going to hemorrhage and she's going to die. This is done to preserve the life of the mother. And then continues the Mishnah, but yotzo roishoi, if the head, or as the Rishonim comment, a major portion of the head has emerged from the birth canal, at this point one does not touch the fetus, shein deichin nefesh mipnei nefesh. At this point, the fetus is considered as if it's already born, and one cannot sacrifice one person in order to save the life of the mother. The Gemara explains this by saying that it's mishamayo karadfilo. She is being pursued by heaven at the point where the fetus is born. This is a natural event, and we have two equal lives. This is now a born baby. It's no longer a fetus. And the result is in Dechin Nefesh Mitnei Nefesh. The Rambam, in codifying the halacha, codifies the halacha precisely as recorded in the Mishnah, but with two significant additions, or I should say, one addition and one minor variation. The Rambam, in recording the halacha in Perek Aleph, Hilchos Ritzeach, Halacha Tes, begins by giving us the general rule with regard to a reitith. Avzu mitzvas loisase shloi lochus al nefesh reitith. The Torah gives us, among its mitzvahs, the mitzvah of loisochus einecha olav, one is not to have mercy upon a person who is intent upon an act of homicide. He is to be eliminated in order to save the life of this innocent victim. Now, it's important to remember that in terms of halacha, this goes beyond the notion of self-defense, which is known in common law. Self-defense is justification for committing what is otherwise an act of homicide. But self-defense is to be understood in a very restricted way. It means the victim can do whatever is necessary in order to save his life. He cannot automatically intervene in order to save the life of a third party. There are some exceptions. If the person who is under threat is a spouse, a child, the legal system recognizes the right of intervention. But if you come upon two strangers in the street and one of them is intent upon killing another, he's got a gun, he's gone berserk, and you try to kill him in order to save the victim, you proceed at your own legal peril. In halacha, not only is intervention permissible, intervention is mandatory. Leisochus einecha olav, don't have mercy on the aggressor. The life of the innocent victim has priority as a matter of statutory halacha. That has nothing to do with the Mishnah and Olos. That is an independent principle of halacha. The Rambam records that in the first chapter of Hilchos Ritzeach, and then in the very same halacha, in the same paragraph, he continues, L'ficho heiru chachomin, she'ubro shimekasholele, therefore, Chazal in the Mishnah taught that if you have a pregnant woman who is in hard travail, she's a makasha leled, it is necessary, indeed mandatory, to perform this embryotomy. That Rambam is difficult. And again, let me just make a general statement which is well known in yeshiva circles. The statement is that whatever the Rambam says, lefichoch, you know you're in trouble. The Rambam here had no better example of a reitei than a fetus who is threatening the life of a mother. I gave you a garden variety example before. You have somebody walks into the room and he goes berserk. That's the garden variety example of a reitif. The Rambam doesn't give you simple examples. Instead, he talks about the uber b'meye imay, and he uses lefichoch, therefore. Somebody once said, quipped, that every time the Rambam uses lefichoch, we know there's a problem. So lefichoch must have a different translation. It can't possibly mean therefore. It has to have some esoteric meaning. But put that aside. The Rambam is saying lefichoch. He is evoking the law of the rodeh, the law of the pursuer, and this is its justification. And then he proceeds to say that Nishahitzi Uber es Reishai, from the time that the head of the fetus has emerged from the birth canal, at this point there is no intervention. And he says, Mipnei Shezehu Tivai Shalaylom. This is the way of the world, where the Mishnah uses the phrase, Ein Deichei Nefesh Mipnei Nefesh, and the Gemara explains this, Mishomayo Karati Lo, heaven is pursuing. The Rambam uses different nomenclature. He says this is nature. Nature is taking its own course. I emphasize those points for one basic reason.
The fact that the Rambam finds it necessary to employ the principle of Redeth in order to justify this embryotomy, the destruction of the fetus. The fact that the Mishnah finds it necessary to say that this is permissible because Chayeho Kedmin Lechayo, that explanatory phrase sounds almost superfluous. If you're dealing with an ordinary transgression, everything is permissible for Pikuach Nefesh. What's the big problem? All the Mishnah has to tell us is that if you have hydrocephalus, it endangers the life of the mother. You can be Machal Shabbos to save a person whose life is in danger. You can eat on Yom Kippur. Why shouldn't I be able to perform an abortion, which is, after all, what this is? The Gemara finds it necessary to tell me, Mipnei Shechayeho Kedmin Lechayov, the life of the mother has precedence. And that's only, or at least the obvious explanation, which may be subject to some dispute, but the obvious explanation is that we are not dealing with an ordinary transgression. We're dealing with a form of ritzicha. We're dealing with feticide. And feticide seems to be a form of homicide. And therefore, it's permissible only because, for some reason, the life of the mother takes precedence over the life of an unborn child. Comes the Rambam, and he tells us why. This is homicide. And why does the life of the mother take precedence over the life of the fetus? Because the fetus is a rodef. The fetus is a pursuer, an aggressor, and the mother is the innocent victim. Now, of course, the fetus has no intention to do any harm to the mother. The fetus has clearly not yet reached the age of reason, and certainly not the age of moral or halachic responsibility. But remember that insofar as a redeth is concerned, guilt is not the crucial element. A person who is engaged in an act of pursuit, even if he is in no way morally culpable, the life of the victim takes precedence in terms of halacha, and that is precisely what the Rambam seems to be codifying. Virtually all of the commentaries on the Rambam, including the Neidiv Yehuda and Reb Chaim Brisker, understand that the Rambam maintains that ordinary abortions constitute an act of homicide. Non-capital homicide, to be sure. There is no capital punishment for destroying the life of the fetus. But the isur, the transgression, is in the category of ritzicha. There are many forms of homicide which don't carry with them capital punishment. In this case, presumably, because in the Einish, when the Torah tells us the prescribed penalty for homicide, it says, Make odom vomeis meis yumos. If you kill a man, and the fetus is not yet a man. However, in the parasha of Ritzicha, where it says Loisirtzach, it doesn't say thou shalt not kill, quote, a man. You shall not kill that which is human in nature. And if we go back to the Mishnah, this is the Rambam's understanding of the Mishnah, then the Mishnah is telling us that a fetus is included in the prohibition of homicide, but not necessarily in the penalty of homicide. So we have non-capital homicide. We know all about that in halacha. A treifa, which I will not attempt to define right now, you kill a person who's suffering from some congenital anomaly or a certain kind of a trauma. Of course it's not permissible to kill this individual. Yet if you do, there's no capital punishment. You kill a non-Jew, the Kesef Mishnah and the Ravan in Bava Kama are quite emphatic, and it's based upon a mechilta, that there is a prohibition of ritzicha. thou shalt not kill includes non-Jews as well. However, in terms of the punishment, capital punishment is not extended to the killing of a non-Jew. So you have another category. We can multiply the members of this class. Individuals who, when you take their life, involves the transgression of resicha, but not necessarily capital punishment. The position of Rambam, as understood by most later authorities, is that feticide, performance of an abortion, is a form of homicide. That's one position. And I suppose I ought to add that everyone agrees that in the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, the performance of an abortion is certainly a form of resich, or I should qualify that by saying almost certainly a form of resich. The Gemara in Sanhedrin quotes a posik. The posik says, "Make nefesh adam bo adam dama yishofech." It's a posik in Parshas Noach. The Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, which I sometimes describe as Judaism's outpatient department. You have a set of rules that are binding all upon non-Jews. They aren't bound by the 613 mitzvahs that were given at Sinai, but they are bound by the seven commandments, six of which were given to the Marishon, the third, Avram and Achai, to Noach when he emerged from the Teva. And here in Parashas Noach, we have the prohibition against homicide. And it's couched in the phrase, Make nefesh odom bo'odom dome yishofech. I pronounce the posik the way we read it. If you look at the trop, Make nefesh odom, there's an asnachto, a little comment. And it means, if you smite the life of a man, bo'odom dome yishofech, by man shall the perpetrator's blood be shed. As distinct from certain other things in the same parasha, which don't carry with it capital punishment at the hands of man, but punishment at the hands of heaven. Comes the Gemara, and the Gemara says, translate the pasuk a little bit differently. All you do is have to change the punctuation, and since the Torah doesn't come with punctuation marks, it's open to different forms of punctuation, and hence, different forms of interpretation. The Drashas Chazal would have us read the posuk, Make nefesh odom bo'odom dome yishofech. If a person smites a man within a man, his blood shall be spilled. Ask the Gemara, Ezehu odom bo'odom, and where do you ever find a man within a man? Answers the Gemara, Zehu ubar b'me'imai. This is the fetus in the womb of its mother. And the conclusion is, don't be yishofer. If you kill this odom ba'odom, then the person who does this, the perpetrator, is to be put to death at the hands of man. That establishes one clear point, namely, that feticide, the destruction of the fetus, is a capital crime in the Noahide Code. Not a capital crime for Jews, but it is a capital crime in the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. Now, what difference does it make whether we're dealing with a Isur Ritzicha or we're dealing with some other prohibition? There is a Tesis in Sanhedrin. Tesis in Sanhedrin says he doesn't know what the halacha is in a situation in which the fetus is threatening the life of the mother. If the fetus is threatening the life of the mother, may a Noachide, may Ben Noach, a non-Jew, may he perform an abortion in order to save the life of the mother. The problem is, and what is the doubt that is expressed in Tesis? We have the principle that we know from the Mishnah and always, that if the two lives are equal, if the fetus has already emerged from the birth canal. If they are equal in value in the sense that each of these lives, if you extinguish it, carries with it capital punishment, it would be logical to assume that insofar as a ben noach is concerned, a fetus is equal in stature, equal in standing in terms of the halachas of ben noach to the mother, and therefore, ein deichin nefesh mit ne nefesh. We have this principle that this is mishamayo karatvi lo. This is tivo shaloylom. It's all natural, and the two are equal in value in this system, and therefore there should be no intervention. I won't bore you by giving you the list of six different analyses of why Tosfos may express the doubt, which I included in a footnote in Bioethical Dilemmas. I'll give you what I regard as the simple explanation. The simple explanation seems to me that Tosfos is in doubt with regard to the nature of feticide in the Noahide Code. The simplest explanation of feticide is that for a ben noach, it's capital homicide. But it's not capital homicide for a Jew. Then why is it capital homicide in the Noahide Code? It may well be that it is a new capital crime. There are other capital crimes in the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach that aren't capital crimes for a Jew. It might just well be the case that the Torah here has been mechadesh. It has devised a totally distinct prohibition. And if you ask l'may nafkamina, the nafkamina is that if you're dealing with an iser of ritzicha, then unless there is some other contravailing reason, there is a principle that ritzicha is not one of the things that you do in order to save a life. But if feticide is like some other capital crime in the Noahide Code, like, for example, theft, then the life of the fetus might well be sacrificed in order to save the life of the mother. That is the suffix, the doubt, that is presented by Tosfos, and that leaves us with something which is very important in terms of non-Jews at least, putting aside any ramifications this may have with regard to Jews. If a non-Jewish obstetrician or gynecologist comes to ask a shaila, what am I supposed to do? I have a mother who is being threatened by the fetus. Do I, as a non-Jew, have a right to perform an abortion? I would be forced to take out the Tosfos and Sanhedrin and to say that if Tosfos doesn't know the answer, I don't know the answer either. And therefore the principle is Shev Al Taseh. You're asking me whether you can perform what is potentially an act of homicide, and my answer is that without clear license, it cannot be sanctioned. I hear tell that there is some moral tradition out there that takes this position, that says, in effect, that an abortion can never be sanctioned under any circumstances, even to preserve the life of the mother. And I submit that that position was transmitted to them sometime way back in the early days of history by Jews, because they had the Messiah of the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach that was transmitted to them by their teachers in antiquity who happened to have been Jews. However, there is one exception which is recognized in that moral system. And that's an invocation of the double effect theory. The double effect theory, I won't try to explain it to you in detail. It says in a nutshell that if you intend to perform a perfectly legitimate act, but in the process you must willy-nilly do something that you shouldn't be doing, but you don't intend that evil effect, this is then permissible. The example that is given in the literature is the case of a pregnant woman who has cancer of the uterus. And the only cure for cancer of the uterus is surgical excision of the uterus. But she's pregnant. which means if you remove the uterus, you may remove the fetus also, and the fetus is not going to survive. This is absolutely accepted in Catholic morality. And if a non-Jew were to come and ask the Rav a Shaila, I prefer they go to somebody else, because here I become extremely confused. What they call double effect, I call a psikresha d'lo nichale. We have these categories of halacha. No, psikresha, I would really, all that I want to do is to amputate the neck of the chicken, but in the process, I'm going to kill the chicken. In effect, what I want to do here is remove a uterus, but in the process, I'm going to kill the fetus also. I certainly don't want to kill the chicken, and I don't want to kill the fetus. For a Jew, this is not exactly permissible. The status of the issue we're not going to talk about. I have evidence from some poskim who maintain that for a non-Jew, this is permissible. And don't ask me why, because that will take us very, very far afield. But I think that there are at least some poskim, not necessarily normative halacha, that maintains that a psikresha d'lo nichale, call it double effect if you like, is permissible for a non-Jew. And I am fairly convinced that though I can only point to late Achronim who dispute this issue, I am absolutely convinced that this must have been a controversy way back in antiquity, and the people who developed this position of morality were taught that a psik resha d'lo nichale is permissible in the Noahide Code. Now all of that is perhaps curious, but it's more than curious. All of that illustrates that we have a significant body of opinion that maintains that abortion is really a form of homicide. That is by no means the only position. There are others who maintain that abortion, of course, abortion is not something that can be performed with impunity. Destruction of a fetus, an abortion, under normal circumstances, is an odious offense. But it need not rise to the level of homicide. The Chavis Yoyer maintained that the prohibition was essentially a prohibition of hashchasas zera, a prohibition of onanism. Destroying the seed is also prohibited. Not a capital prohibition by any means, but prohibited nonetheless. In effect, the Chavis Yoyer maintains that a developing fetus is nothing more than a drop of sperm that is dividing and dividing and dividing, and until it's born, it's just a sperm cell that has developed. But destroying a sperm cell is also prohibited under usual circumstances. This position in itself is interesting and has ramifications in halacha. If you start with the position of the Rambam that we're dealing with either homicide or quasi-homicide, the act can be justified only to save the life of the mother. If we're dealing with some kind of lesser prohibition, then it is conceivable that the act is permissible for other reasons as well. The Yavitz, or Yaakov Emden, cites the Chavis Yoyer, and he adopts that position, and he applies it in rather novel and interesting ways. He was dealing with a bastard fetus, a fetus that, if allowed to continue to term, would be a mamzer. And of course, this will create all kinds of difficulties, not to speak of shame and embarrassment for the family. So, Rabbi Yaakov Emden does two things. First, he agrees with the Chavis Yoyer. The prohibition against feticide is the prohibition against Hashkosa, Zera, Lavatola, Onanism. And then he proceeds to give a very novel definition and hence limitation of the prohibition of Hashkosa, Zera, Lavatola. The term technically means emission of seed for waste, for no purpose. And what is no purpose? We have attempts to define purpose so that you can, by creating a dichotomy, say that what is not a recognized purpose is hence no purpose and therefore prohibited. A havamina, only considered by Tesis to be rejected, is that intercourse with a woman who is not fertile, postmenopausal, or a woman who cannot have children for other reasons, might well be ashkosa zera levatola. Tesis quickly dismisses that and says that normal, natural intercourse can never be considered levatola. That's not purposeless. It's perfectly sanctioned. That is not what the Torah has forbidden. And then we have a sugi of Gimel Noshim with the opinion of Reb Meir, who maintains that certain forms of contraceptives are permissible in case of a woman for whom pregnancy would be a danger. And the explanation, or the standard explanation, is that this is normal intercourse for women in whom pregnancy would pose a danger. Comes Rabbi Yankiv Emden, and he in effect is expanding the area of permissible ejaculation. He says in effect, levatola is taken literally. Levatola is for no good purpose. If you have any legitimate purpose in this hashkasa zera, it becomes permissible. Sar godol, great pain. Avoidance of great pain is for him reason to sanction destruction of the seed. Says he, what could be greater pain and anguish than the shame, embarrassment, humiliation of having to raise a mamzer? Therefore, the abortion can be sanctioned for purposes of eliminating a bastard fetus. Reb Moshe Feinstein, Zecherono Livracha, citing this Yaivitz, who is the basis of at least the opinion of one recognized Pesach, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who maintained that the elimination of a Tay-Sachs baby, the elimination of a Down syndrome baby, is permissible because, look, Rabbi Yankiv Emden says, it's the Yisr Vashkosa Zera Levatolo, it's permissible, it's a Godel. Nobody is in a position to say that the burden of raising a mongoloid, the burden of raising a Tay-Sachs baby, is not a Tsar Godel. It certainly is something that involves a great deal of emotional anguish, and citing the Yaivitz, he rules this is permissible. Reb Moshe Feinstein, Zecherono Livracha, dismisses that position out of hand. And of the Yaivitz, not of Rabbi Waldenberg, he says, Shore le more, may his master forgive him. Rather strong language which Reb Moshe did not often use. But the Yaivitz was known for occasion assuming positions that were far, far out of the mainstream of halacha. And this is one of the cases in which mainstream poskim reject the position of Rabbi Yankiv Emden. The third position is the position of the Maharit, and there are great problems with the Maharit, because we have two tshuvas in the Maharit, Tzadik Zayin and Tzadik Tes, which seem to contradict each other. But the Maharit's position, if you read him literally, is that abortion is prohibited simply because it's a form of chavolah, literally wounding, non-therapeutic wounding. And then you have later authorities disagreeing. What kind of wounding are we talking about? Is this wounding of the mother, or is this wounding of the fetus? But be that as it may, for the Maharit, we're dealing with a infraction which is not in the same category as a prohibition of homicide, or even Beitzah Zera Levatola. On the contrary, Chavolah, if you're talking about wounding, there is a major exception to the prohibition against chavolah. Therapeutic wounding, it's called surgery, is absolutely permissible in halacha. That's not the chavolah that the Torah prohibited. According to the Maharit, any therapeutic abortion for the benefit of the mother would be permissible, and the mother's life does not necessarily have to be in danger. So you have these different positions, and when you're dealing with questions of halacha, in terms of what circumstances may an abortion be permitted, and what circumstances is an abortion not permitted, the determination of the halacha in any given case is dependent upon which of these theories with regard to the prohibition of feticide does one accept. That's the basis. That's where it all begins. And as I mentioned earlier, you have many authorities who maintain that an abortion can be performed only when there is a direct threat to the life of the mother, and absent such threat to the life of the mother, it cannot be sanctioned, because we're dealing with what is essentially a prohibition in the form of homicide or quasi-homicide. That's the beginning of all of this. Then come the wrinkles, the applications, the ins and outs. An abortion within the first 40 days of gestation. Of course, the Mishnah always is talking about a woman in hard travail. That woman is presumably in the 9th month of pregnancy. But does that mean that the elimination of the fetus at earlier stages of pregnancy is necessarily also a category of homicide? Well, there are some authorities who maintain that within the first 40 days of pregnancy, there is no problem. Why is there no problem? Because of the Gemara in Yevamos Daf Samech Tes Omed Aleph. Rav Chisda says that if you have a woman who has married a Kohen, and the husband dies, she may continue to eat Truma within the first 40 days of her marriage, provided that she is also a Bas Kohen. Now, what we're dealing with here is a question of whether the woman is pregnant or the woman is not pregnant. If the woman is pregnant, she may be prohibited to eat truma because she is bearing a child who cannot render her permissible to eat truma. If she becomes pregnant, then she is disqualified. However, during the first 40 days of gestation, says the Gemara, it makes no difference whether she's pregnant or not, because mayo bialmo. So if the husband unfortunately dies at a very early stage of the marriage, for the first 40 days after the marriage, even if she became pregnant on the wedding night, she can continue to partake of truma until 40 days after the marriage. Because even if she has a fetus, this fetus is considered to be nothing more than mayo bialmo. There are other indications that the fetus in the first 40 days of pregnancy has a different status from the fetus after the first 40 days of pregnancy. There's a Mishnah Nida, Rabbi Shmuel's position is that a woman who suffers a spontaneous miscarriage has no defilement associated with Leida if she aborts within the first 40 days and the abortus is male, nor does she have tumas leida if she aborts a female fetus within the first 80 days. Please don't ask me how you can determine the sex of a fetus within the first 40 days. I haven't the vaguest idea, but that is the position of Rabbi Shmuel. What is even more interesting is that Aristotle adopts that position, not for Tumas Leiva. Aristotle doesn't know anything about Tumas Leiva. There's no Tumas Leiva in Sheva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach. But Aristotle was talking about feticide, abortion. And he regarded the abortion of a male fetus in the first 40 days as innocuous, and of a female fetus within the first 80 days as innocuous. And that was, once upon a time, the position of the church. The church modified its position much later. But that was the Aristotelian position. It's also the position of Rabbi Shmuel for purposes of Tumas Leida. And what is even more curious, the Septuagint, which should not be confused with the Targum Shivim. The Targum Shivim we know about.
The Targum Sheevim was the Greek translation that was prepared by Chachmei Yisrael. The Greek Septuagint, which is extant now, is not the same as the original Targum Sheevim. How do we know that? Because the Gemara Megillah gives us a whole list of changes that were made by Chazal when they translated from Hebrew into Greek. Those changes aren't in the Septuagint. But there are other changes. One of the changes, which I find very remarkable, is the Pasuk in Parashas Mishpatim, Vim Osen Yiyah, and Lo Yiyah Osen. In context, we're talking about whether a person performs an act of assault against a pregnant woman and she miscarries. Is he liable for monetary compensation? As we read the Pasuk, if there will be a misadventure, meaning that the victim dies, this person is guilty of something far more serious, so we don't assign a financial penalty for tort damages. That's the principle of Kim Leibidarabimine. You give the more serious punishment and he's exonerated from the lesser punishment. If, however, there is no death, so there's no other punishment, then he pays compensation. The Septuagint translates this as saying, if the fetus shall be with form, which means 40 days, then no damages. If the fetus shall be without form, then there are damages. The Septuagint clearly thought that you're dealing with homicide after 40 days because the fetus is a human being, and if you kill the fetus, there is some kind of culpability. But within the 40-day period, it's not yet a nefesh, and therefore there is no penalty. Again, I suspect that this probably came from Jewish sources. And I also would say that we have here at least some support for the position that forget about the status of the fetus within the first 40 days for Jews. For non-Jews, the fetus within the first 40 days is not a person, and if you kill the fetus by performing abortion within the first 40 days, there is no capital liability in Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach. And if you ask me to explain it, I find the explanation very easy. The explanation is, where do we derive this prohibition against feticide in the Noahide Code? Makin nefesh odom bo'odom. Ezehu odom bo'odom. That's uber me'ima. How do we know that feticide is not a capital crime for Jews? Because it says makin odom me'ishumos. And the fetus isn't an odom. If he's not an odom for purposes of halacha, we have an odom be'odom, who is a person for purposes of ritzich in the Noahide Code, but it may well be the case that in less than 40 days he's not considered to be an odom. Insofar as Jews are concerned, the position of the fetus within the first 40 days is not considered a entity for which there is the same type of culpability as a fetus after the 40 days was probably first expressed by the late Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberger. His position was challenged by Rav Unterman. Rav Weinberger, his tshuva originally appeared in Noam, an Israeli publication, and later when he compiled the Sri Deyesh, he incorporated that tshuva, and there's a little asterisk with a note at the bottom. And the note says that now that I have seen the article prepared by my colleague, Rabbi Unterman Sorachian, he says, needs further reflection. It's not by any means a clear-cut affirmation of his earlier position. There are other poskim who have come down on both sides of that issue. So what we have is a very serious and significant controversy with regard to the status within the first 40 days, which again has all kinds of applications. The simplest application is not with regard to amniocentesis, which can't be performed that early, but villi sampling, which will accomplish the same thing and can be carried out in the first 40 days, or better, the morning after pill. The morning after pill, assuming that it has the effect of an abortifacient, is something which is used in the very early stage of pregnancy. If this does not carry with it some type of iser in halacha, then presumably it would be permissible, and here we have this very, very basic controversy. There are other distinctions that I think have to be recognized. Whether they have practical applications or whether they don't have practical applications is something entirely different. In terms of contemporary fertility treatments, in terms of contemporary scientific research, in vitro fertilization involves fertilizing female ova in a petri dish, using some of them, and then discarding others. There are other procedures that are done. You can now do chromosomal analysis at the four-cell stage to determine whether the fetus is a Tay-Sachs baby or it's carrying some other congenital defect. And if it is, you destroy it. Otherwise, you implant it in the uterus and you hope that you will have a successful pregnancy. The question of these, I call them surplus ova, the ova that have been fertilized and aren't going to be used, can they be destroyed with impunity? Obviously, if you can destroy them within the first 40 days, there's no problem. If it's also within the first 40 days, does this mean that it's always prohibited? If you talk about stem cell research, which involves other problems, which we'll talk about, but the stage at which you're going to destroy them is certainly far earlier than the 40th day of gestation, and that carries with it the same kind of problem. In the very earliest stages of gestation, it seems to me that there is another principle that might be invoked. So far, as I will explain, I think it's more theoretical than actual, but who knows what science has in store tomorrow or the day after. There is a general principle in halacha which has become popularized in recent months, at least on the other side of the Hudson, where we have insect infestation of water. And people were arguing that even there are little bugs in the water, what difference does it make? Invoking the Aruch HaShulchan, which everybody is familiar with, the Aruch HaShulchan became aware of a phenomenon that everyone who's had a freshman course in biology has experienced. One of the most exciting things in a biology lab is taking a drop of water, putting it on a slide, and examining it under a microscope. You can see the bugs swimming around in the drop of water. Literally, the water is teeming with microorganisms. Says the Aruch HaShulchan, this is a sheretz hasheretz b'mayim. You're dealing with creepy things in the water. What's the difference between this and a lobster? A lobster's a little bit bigger. This is a little bit smaller. The principle that the Aruch HaShulchan develops is that halacha is not concerned with sub-visual phenomena. Halacha was given to mortals, not to angels, and not even to scientists. The Torah was given to people with 20/20 eyesight, but not people who have microscopes. Therefore, by definition, this is not a sheretz. A sheretz, you know, Torah is a technical document, and every word has a precise meaning. The word sheretz doesn't mean creepy things. It means what halacha says is a creeping thing. And if you don't have to take account of microscopic organisms, then these are not shrotzim. They're not creepy things, period, full stop. There are other areas in which the same principle applies. Everybody knows that if you have a letter and tefillin, mezuzah, sefer Torah, that is severed and there is space between parts of the letter, the tefillin, the mezuzah, the sefer Torah is fossil. You don't need a microscope. If you have a magnifying glass that has sufficient power, you will be able to see that there are vast chasms in every letter. Does that mean it's nifsak? And the answer is that if a person looking at it with the naked eye can't see the space, there's no space. For all intents and purposes, what you don't see does not exist. Subvisual phenomena are not existent. Or if you want the Latin maxim, de minimis non curat lex, the law does not take cognizance of trifles. They probably also got it from us. But this is a principle of halacha. I would have been prepared to argue that in the earliest stages of gestation, when the organism, the developing zygote, is not perceivable to the naked eye, as far as halacha is concerned, it doesn't exist. If it doesn't exist, you can do whatever you want with it. My hesitation is a statement that was published only recently by, in the name of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I say in the name of advisedly, because there are two tshuvas of Rav Shlomo Zalman dealing with the same problem published in two different works. One is called the Minchas Yaakov Chelik Beis, and the other, Minchas Shlomo Chelik Beis, and the other is called Minchas Shlomo Tinyona, published by different people. And you have what purports to be the same writing, the same tshuva. It deals with Esrig, of all things. And his problem is whether bees pollinate an Esrig using pollen that they've gotten from lemons, which is bound to happen. The bees do not observe boundary lines. And if you have an Esrig pardes in Eretz Yisrael, there is nothing to stop a bee from lighting first on a lemon tree a couple of kilometers away and then lighting on the Esrig tree. So he's dealing with the problem of Murkav. You have now an Esrig that has some kind of genetic makeup that comes from elsewhere. Is this sufficient to passel the Esrig? Don't worry, he says it doesn't passel the Esrig. But in the process, he discusses genetic engineering. And in one of these responses, and they purport to be the same material, in one of these, he says that yes, genetic engineering, you want to take a gene from one species and put it into another species, you're worried about prohibitions of klayim, prohibitions of yetzeh, one prohibition, another prohibition. He says, yeah, you've got to worry about these things. Even though, quoting this well-accepted principle, that which is subvisual doesn't count, and nobody can see a gene without magnification, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, nevertheless, kivon shebnei odom mitaplim boy, it has some standing in halacha. I frankly am unsure with regard to what he means. Bnei odom mitaplim, people do things with it. Does that mean that since it is removed from the entity in which it was originally created, you take one gene out of some organism and you play around with it in one way or another, it in effect becomes a freestanding organism having status of its own, which for some reason endows it with a certain cheshivus, a certain importance and status? Or does he mean because if you take a little gene and you lift it and put it someplace else, it has a potential to develop into a significant organism? You take a little microorganism, some little bug that's in the water, it's never going to become a lobster or even a shrimp. It's going to remain a microorganism for all of its natural life. But you take a gene from whatever and put it someplace else, it's going to develop into something, and since it's potentially an entity in halacha, then it's got a status of an entity from its very inception. The application in terms of a zygote in the early stages of gestation is clear. If you accept that position, then this developing zygote, which is being manipulated in the laboratory, it's freestanding, it's being manipulated. If he means because it's going to develop into an organism, well, clearly it is going to develop in an organism. So my original position, I now have grounds, at least for hesitation, because of the statements of Rav Shlomo Zalman. In the real world, I don't think that it makes any difference today. Again, I say nothing about tomorrow. The organism that is either implanted in the woman's ovary, in the woman's uterus, after in vitro fertilization or destroyed, is at roughly the 150 cell stage. I've never seen one of these, with or without a magnifying glass. They tell me that its circumference is equal to roughly one half of the circumference of a period in the type font used by the New York Times. I now ask you, can you see half a period in the New York Times with 20/20 eyesight. I can't, but I don't have 20/20 eyesight. I suspect that some people could. So I am afraid that at this 150 cell stage, it may be visual, but who knows? Tomorrow they may learn how to do all of this a little bit earlier, and then this becomes a significant consideration. There is one other consideration which is bandied about, and if I read the media, if I read secondary sources, it's bandied about as if it's accepted with equanimity by everybody. And that is that a fetus that develops outside of the mother's body is not a fetus for purposes of halacha. I know of only one pesach of any standing who has adopted that position. And that is Reb Moshe Sternbuch, who is a formidable Talmud Chacham. He has stated the position in an article that appeared in Bishvilei HaRefuah, published by the Niado Hospital, was published some 25 or 30 years ago, and the statement is made without argument and without citation of sources. He simply states it as if it were obvious. I find it far from obvious. But before explaining why I find it far from obvious, I'll play devil's advocate. I will try to give you sources that might substantiate that position. The sources that might substantiate that position is a tshuva of Chacham Tzvi Simen Tzadik Gimel. The Chacham Tzvi was asked a very, very important question. There seems to have been some place that didn't have a tenth man for a million. Zolzich Nishtrefen Vishetrefzach. But they had somebody who had created a golem, and they wanted to know whether you can use the golem as the tenth man to the minyan. So the Chacham Tzvi analyzes the problem, and he begins with a flat statement. He says, one thing is certain, that if you kill the golem, there is no capital punishment. Why? And he proceeds to quote the Gemara in Sanhedrin, like quoted before, the prohibition of abortion in the Noahide Code, Ezehu Odom Ba'odom, Zehu Uber B'meyimai. An Odom Ba'odom, a man within a man, this is not a man within a man. The Golem came from clay, from earth, from water, who knows from what. It does not spring from a mother's womb. Therefore, killing the Golem presents no problem whatsoever. The Chacham Tzvi seems to be saying that something which is produced, gestates, outside of a uterus is not an odom ba'odom, and therefore there is no prohibition against destroying it. So, if you have something which is developing in the petri dish, you've got these surplus fertilized ova, it stands to reason you can do whatever you want with them because they are not an odom ba'odom. It sounds very interesting. However, it's not nearly what it seems to be for a number of reasons. Number one, I'll give you a kind of argument which is a reductio ad absurdum. It doesn't prove very much, but it creates a visceral reaction. As long as you're talking about a golem, we'll soon see the Gemara talks about killing a golem. That's the least of my problems. If you have a golem, I'm willing to see it be killed. It's all right. There's a different problem I have. My problem is Huxley's Brave New World. Today, you develop a zygote in a petri dish to the 150 cell stage. And next month, next year, next century, who says that you can construct an incubator in the laboratory and allow it to develop to term? You provide the necessary nutrients, or I provide the right environment. You create an artificial uterus. If you can create an artificial heart, why can't you create an artificial uterus? We've got it. It's called an incubator. All you have to know is how to deal with this developing embryo in the incubator. Will you now tell me that this entity, which is developed in an incubator for 9 months, And then you send him off to school, to college, to university, and he grows to maturity like any other person, that now if I kill him, there's no prohibition of homicide because he's not an Odom, the Odom. It somehow does not make sense to me. I would have said several things. I would have said that Rabbi Yankov Emden is clear, that the Chacham Tzvi is clearly wrong. He's clearly wrong on a number of grounds. Number one, this is the Noachite code, Shev Mitzvot Shmei Noach. A goy, maybe he doesn't get Ritzicha for this. The prohibition of Ritzicha for Jews does not come from that Pasuk at all. It's Loisirtzach. Where do we have this exclusion? Number two, since when do we assume that Droshes Chazal contradict the Pshutei Shel Mikro? When Chazal tell us, Ezeu Odom Ba'odom, Zeu Uber B'mei Imai, I submit to you, Halacha L'maisa, if next Parshas Korach, the Baal Korah has heard what we've talked about tonight, or the Baal Korah is a Talmud Chacham who remembers the Gemara in Sanhedrin, and he reads the Pasuk, Ma kenevesh Odom Ba'odom, Yuma Ba'odom Doma Yishofech. He reads Ma'ke Nefesh Odom Ba'odom, puts the Asnachta there, and says Doma Yishofech. I submit he has to read the Pasuk over again. Because it's a clear halacha that if you mispronounce the words in Chumash in a way that distorts the meaning, even if you've read every word correctly, you're not Yetzer Kriya Sotayr. Of course this is the meaning for the Drashas Chazal. Does that mean that the simple, literal meaning of the Pasuk has been obliterated? Chazal knew very well that the literal meaning of the Pasuk was Makin Nefesh Odom, Ba'odom Domi Yishofech. And now we have what is a kind of a ribuy, a pleonasm of one kind or another. It is a new halacha. It is not exclusively to be interpreted this way. This becomes an inclusive drosha for establishing the parameters of the Isra Tzicha. But it doesn't exclude anything that would have been within the boundaries of the Isra Tzicha without the drosha of Chazal. And in any event, Rabbi Yankov Emden, in the conclusion of the tshuva, cites the Gemara that said Rav Zeira created a Golem with a Sefer Yetzirah, and because he didn't like what he created, he said, Tuvla Afro, I told him to go back to dust. He eliminated him. Says Rabbi Yankov Emden, number one, he certainly didn't violate the Yisra Tzicha. That he deals with easily. But if he could have been used as a minion man, why did he destroy him? Obviously, this person was useless for anything. A, he wasn't a Jew. And B, he wasn't even a human being. So the Golem for Rabbi Yankov Emden is not to be equated with a human, and therefore the basic tshuva of the Chacham Tzvi cannot very well be invoked for the status of an ex utero pregnancy. So we have those basic sources dealing with this, and we have a consideration of the status of the fetus in various stages of gestation. And insofar as a fetus that develops ex utero is concerned, I have absolutely no source in Gemara or in early Rishonim that in any way distinguish between a pregnancy that is in utero or an artificial pregnancy taking place ex utero. And these considerations go basically not to the fertility procedures themselves, but they go to other issues entirely, the problems that arise in using these fertility procedures. If you talk about things like cloning per se, therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning seems to me to be not terribly different from the creation of a Golem. I'm not in favor of reproductive cloning. I'm not in favor of creating a Golem either. If you'll ask me what's the prohibition against creating the Golem, I'll send you to the nearest Mekubal if you can find him, and he will proceed to tell you that Kabbalah knows about all kinds of things that you can do. It's called white magic. You harness the Merkav Elyona to accomplish all kinds of things. And yet, Every Kabbalist will tell you, you proceed at your own peril. You can wreak havoc, not only in this terrestrial world, but even in the Lome Sel Yonim, in celestial spheres also. Reproductive cloning is dangerous for a lot of reasons. Reproductive cloning is dangerous in terms of the human society as we know it. It's dangerous in terms of what you're doing in the process. I'm really over time, but I'll take just a few minutes more. The late Professor Ramsey wrote a book. And the thesis of this particular book, he was a Methodist minister, a professor of philosophy in Princeton, and one of the earliest bioethicists. His position was that all fetal experimentation is by definition immoral. Why? Because until you do the experiments, you have no idea whether you're placing a burden upon the neonate that's going to develop. You can do all kinds of things, but how do you know that there isn't going to be a congenital anomaly, either physical or mental or what have you? And you don't have consent of the fetus. What right do you have to artificially create situations in which babies are born with all kinds of genetic burdens? Once, when we were both at a conference and he was explaining his basic position, to his delight, I told him that there is ancient Talmudic precedent for his position. When Chazal told us, Lo yisa odom isho mi mishpachas nichvin, Lo yisa odom isho mi mishpachas mitzeroyim, you have the earliest piece of eugenic legislation. I'm not now going to enter into a technical question of whether that is an actual prohibition. Don't marry a woman who comes from a family of epileptics or a woman who comes from a family of mitzeroyim. Don't ask me what mitzeroyim are. One thing I do know, it's not leprosy. It's something else. I have no idea what it was. I don't know whether nichpin is the same as the modern-day epilepsy or it's something else. But I do know that Chazal thought that it was a genetically transmitted disorder, and that's what's crucial. Did they formally interdict this, or is this a kind of, you know, good advice? Don't do things like this. And why shouldn't you do things like this? Because, yes, nature does all kinds of things. Shem Shleim Hashem, the Ribbono Shel Olam is running the world, but that doesn't mean that I have to assume risks when I know that I'm assuming risks. And those risks place a burden on a life that has not yet been created. I have no right to purposely and willfully create situations in which children are born with genetic defects. Find some other way of procreation. Essentially, reproductive cloning in its experimental stages carries with it very serious risks. Everybody knows that. As did all fetal experimentation, until it's shown that the procedure is virtually innocuous. So that it seems to me that reproductive cloning is something that Judaism would not countenance because of these general considerations. But when you talk about therapeutic cloning, strangely enough, there I see actual problems, real problems, not these general amorphous problems in forms of an etzotoyva, in forms of ethical considerations, but the technical problems of feticide. Because if you have in the process of stem cell research or what have you, if you have created an organism that can develop to term and you willfully destroy it, this is the destruction of a nascent human being, and for most poskim, it seems to me, presents serious questions which you now have to adjudicate. Are you prepared to rule unequivocally that within the first 40 days all this is permissible? I'm not sure that anyone is prepared to say that, or that anybody should be prepared to say that, which leaves you with the basic problem. Let me just conclude with one observation, and that is that one often hears that all of this is so, so wonderful. I remember in the early days of in vitro fertilization, when the first reports were published, a gentleman who was not a Pesach, not even an Orthodox rabbi, but a gentleman who had some credentials in the community, issued a statement in which he said, how wonderful all of this is. It now enables people who otherwise could not do so to fulfill the mitzvah pru revu, in effect, making it mandatory to utilize those procedures. Let me make one observation. This observation also is controversial, but it seems to me that there are a whole list of achrenim that I could point to who make the point explicitly, and I will try to show it to you on the basis of a tesis. Tesis in Bava Basra and Chagigah. Tesis in Bava Basra asks a question with regard to a Gemara. The Gemara talks about a chatzi eved chatzi ben chirim. You have a man who belonged to two masters. They held him in partnership. One of them frees his half of the slave, and the other one is still a slave. Now you've got a problem. The problem isn't whether you can make him work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because the part that's half is entitled to at least half the time off. That's easy. The problem is, and who is this person supposed to marry? An Eved cannot marry a Bas Yisrael. He's prohibited to marry a woman of Jewish birth. And the part that is free cannot marry a Shifra Knainis, can't marry a female slave. Says the Gemara, since this person can never marry, therefore, Kishinus Rabbi, you force the master who owns 50% to emancipate him. And he becomes a free man, and he can do what any other free man does. That's the Gemara blanket statement. Comes Tesis and asks a question. What's the big problem? We have a principle of asei deiche loisase. A positive commandment negates a negative commandment. You have a linen garment and you have tcheles, which has to be wool. You put the tcheles into the linen garment because the mitzvah of gedilin tasulocha supersedes the prohibition against shatnez. He has a mitzvah for uruvu. He has a mitzvah to procreate, and the prohibition against marrying the slave is an isra of Yekodesh. So let the assay supersede or take priority over the los assay. And Tesvis, the answer is X-rated. Tesvis distinguishes between the moment in the act of sexual intercourse where you transgress, that's at the very beginning, and the point at which you fulfill the positive commandment, which Tesis places somewhat later in the sexual act. And I ask you a very simple question. The principle which Tesis is enunciating, and it's elementary, is that asei deicha loisase, only the two take place simultaneously. At the very moment that you're transgressing, you're also fulfilling a commandment. But if there is any delay, if there's any intermission between those two, if you have violated the negative commandment and only satisfied the positive commandment at some later time, there is no principle of asei deicha loisase. I understand that it takes 9 months from conception until birth. This does not sound simultaneous to me. And that's not what Tesis answers. Tesis makes all kinds of distinctions with regard to the act of intercourse itself. What is Tesis telling us? Let me ask you a more fundamental question. The mitzvah pru revu is incumbent upon the male of the species. Females do not have a mitzvah pru revu. They may be subject to other commandments. The mitzvah of Sheves, Medivrei Kabbalah, comes from the prophetic period. It's not recorded in Chumash. And now my problem is a serious one. I have not yet heard of a male who has given birth to a child, motion picture junior notwithstanding. I have it on good authority, A, that it is within the realm of scientific possibility, that even today, males could bear children as Hollywood would have them do. I also have B from the same authority. Don't try it. It's extremely dangerous. I'm sure that's not what the Torah commands the male to do when it says, pru revu amilus haaretz. How can there be a mitzvah pru revu addressed to the male? Males do not suffer labor pains. They don't enter labor rooms for purposes of parturition. To accompany their wives, maybe, but not to give birth. It seems to me that it is clear that the mitzvah of Pirya Verivya is a commandment with regard to the sexual act. The Rambam, the Gemara in Shabbos, when it talks about questions the person will be asked B'yom HaDin, the question is never, how many children did you have? The question is, Osakto b'pirya v'rivya. Did you engage in procreation? It is perfectly possible for a male to marry a woman who is perfectly normal, healthy, fertile, to engage in intercourse on a regular basis and never become a father. Mathematically improbable, but not impossible by any means. This person has fulfilled the mitzvah of Pirya Verivya. How do I know that? Because when the Rambam records the mitzvah of Pirya Verivya, he says, Chayev Adam Livo Ba'ino Amur B'teira Ad Shiyah Leben Abbas. What is the obligation of procreation? To engage in Pirya Verivya, in the act that leads to procreation, at the halachically stipulated intervals. And if you want to know what they are, just read the Rashi and the story of Yaakov and Esav in Chumash. If he has done that, then he has fulfilled his commandment. Ad Sheila ben Abbas, until such time as he becomes the father of a male child and a female child. The birth of a child, of a male and a female child, children, is the terminus ad quem. It's like the shear. You've got to eat matzah on Pesach. How much matzah do you have to eat? Till yidikazayis, you're finished. How long do you have to engage in these acts? Until he has ben ubas. But the mitzvah is the act itself. And the ben ubas, this is the shear of the mitzvah. Whether an individual who becomes a parent through some type of in vitro fertilization or what have you, whether he has, whether